Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily and these days more than daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and James Morris, the former Labour pollster, now at Edelman. So the papers today are filled with reaction and analysis of Nigel Farage's decision to stand down candidates in 317 seats. 317 seats that the Tories won in 2017. Now, listeners of the podcast will have heard James and I's thoughts already. So I wonder, James, behaving a real mix, actually, particularly looking at what pollsters are saying on this, how much of an impact this is going to have. I spoke to some on the Conservative campaign who ultimately seem to have the takeaway message of it's better than nothing, but it doesn't take them all the way because Nigel Farage will still likely stand candidates in their target seats, Labour Tory seats. Do you think that this is going to, what Nigel Farage has already proposed, is going to help the Tory party much in terms of getting a majority?
It's going to help a lot. So before he made that announcement, in those seats they needed to hold, they needed to try and pick up those Brexit Party voters. As a result of this announcement, they don't have to compete with the Brexit Party for those voters anymore. Those voters have got a choice, which is a clear Brexit Party, the Tories, or the Labour Party, which is not very clear what its actual proposal with respect to Brexit is, but it's clearly not straight leave. So that means there's a lot less effort needed in those places. The way campaigns work, they have to decide where to put their effort. And if you're not having to spend hundreds of thousands or millions of pounds targeting those seats, and if you're not having to send campaigners into those places, you can send them somewhere else. So they can send them to the seats that Labour are trying to defend. We've also heard Labour are fighting the opposite campaign, so they're just putting resources into the seats they want to win primarily. 80% of the resources are going to the seats they're trying to attack, which means that those seats they're defending are going to be pretty weakly defended. And so this makes it much easier for the Tories to pick those places up.
Now we're back to having a two James podcast, Spectator James. What are you picking up in terms of how cabinet ministers, Tory MPs and those at CCHQ are responding to the news?
So I think everyone in the Tory party is trying to downplay the importance of what Nigel Farage says, trying to say, look, he's logically, the logic of his argument is that the Brexit Party, you know, a vote for them might result in no Brexit at all and might result in Jeremy Corbyn. So he needs to follow through on the logic of his position and stand down his candidates in everywhere, basically, essentially. You know, all those marginal Labour-held seats that the Tories want to win. I think they want to keep the pressure on him to do that up. They want to keep the pressure that is coming to him from donors, from other kind of, you know, big figures in inverted commas in the Brexit movement on him to do that. And so I think they're not going to admit how helpful it is, because I think not only what James has said is true, but I also think he has sent an implicit message that if you want to get Brexit done, you need to vote for Boris Johnson, which is essentially the Tory message in this campaign. And I think that will help them in those Labour-held marginals. They've got a real... If you're the Tory candidate in, say, Ashfield, and you're on a doorstep of a Brexit Party Tory waverer, you have a very simple squeeze message now, which is, look, even Nigel Farage admits that you've got to have a Conservative majority government to get this done, to get us out of the EU. Even he admits that if you get a Labour government, that's not going to happen. And this is one of those, what the Tories like to say, one of the 9 seats that we need to win. So you've got to vote for us here to get it done. I think that will enable the Tories to squeeze the Brexit Party down. I think if you also look at this since the start of a campaign, we've had no backlash or no apparent backlash to Boris Johnson missing his October 31st deadline. You've had the Brexit Party standing down in half a country. I fail to see what the equivalent bits of good news that the opposition parties have had. And I think that does suggest that the Tories are having the better of it so far.
I think the one caveat to that is that not all Brexit Party voters are primarily motivated by Brexit. So there was a poll out about 10 days ago which asked people, what's the most important issue to you and your family? Amongst Brexit Party voters, only about 2 in 5 of them said Brexit was one of the most important issues to them. So there's a big chunk of these people who are just generically anti-establishment. And some of those are more anti-Tory than they are anti-Labour because of the history of the places where they are in some of these northern and midlands towns. And so if the Brexit Party were going to get, say, 18, 20 points in those seats, some of that is hardcore Brexit. That will just automatically flow over to the Tories. But the other chunk of it, and we just don't know how big that chunk is, seat by seat, is potentially still up for grabs. And if they go back to Labour, because a lot of these people have had a Labour history, then actually the effect could be very different to what we'd expect looking at the top line national polls and the political strategy. And in 2015, people were overconfident in their ability to read the impact of UKIP on the election. And I think there's a risk that the most obvious analysis is taken to be necessarily true, when in fact there's a lot of assumptions underneath it, some of which could come unpicked and it could unravel in a different way.
Now, one of the reasons the Tories have been reluctant to have a formal pact with the Brexit Party is ultimately the signal that would send to some of their voters who would be sceptical of the Brexit Party, Tory Remain voters who they hope are going to stick with the party but realise might feel somewhat isolated by the current approach, let alone a formal Nigel Farage pact. James, since we have seen this alliance, which I think, alliance would be the wrong word, Nigel Farage has called it a unilateral pact because they've ultimately moved and they're saying the Conservatives haven't, even though it does feel as though the Tories responded to some things they were saying in terms of their Twitter output. But you've quickly seen all the opposition parties try and say this is a Trump alliance, trying to say, look, they're working together. Do you think that this could backfire at all from the Tory point of view, that even though they haven't said they're working with Nigel Farage, the fact that he is saying we have this pact, which I've decided to create on my own, could suggest, you know, what some Tories are worried about. So the idea that by teaming up with them, which they haven't done, but some could say they have, from the arrangements, you lose some, I suppose, yeah, more metropolitan Remain voters.
Yeah, I think that's right. And not just metropolitan. I think the metropolitan Remain voters are more
cliche,
likely to
maybe,
have
yeah,
gone. But I think if you go to some of, go to David Gawke's seat, go to like some of these places that have towns, but sturdy Protestant English towns, you can have a lot of Remain voters there too. And that is a risk, right? That is a risk that for those voters, the image of the Brexit Party is antagonistic and puts them off. The advantage for the Tory party is, well, so imagine they're repelled from the Tory party. Where do they go? If they go to the mirror image and find themselves at the Liberal Democrats, that's probably not going to hurt the Tory prospects at all. So that division on the Remain side weakens the constituency by constituency effect of this repulsion that will be created.
Now, moving away from the Brexit party, the fight that we're seeing the Tories try to pick with Labour is on economic credibility. Now, we've discussed in this podcast the spending pledges last week. The Tories are going for another attack today on Labour's status on the economy and where they can be trusted. James, is it working?
So I think that, weirdly enough, it's one of those political fights where everyone feels that they're winning. The Tories feel that they are landing, that Labour are spending seriously large amounts of money, much larger amounts of money than the Tories. And the new Tory attack today is that is inevitably going to result in higher taxes. And
they're saying how much per household?
I think it's 2,400. And don't just think that the rich are going to pay this. You know, there aren't enough rich people to bear the cost of this. You know, Corbyn is going to cost you more. The Tories think they're landing that message. On the other hand, Labour are surprisingly relaxed about this attack. I mean, for all the fact they're going to call it fake news and all this, it's because they think it's getting across their message, which is they're going to spend a seriously large amount of cash, which will be transformative. You know, if you really want difference, vote Labour. And I think they think that this is actually reinforcing their change message. I think the key point, though, actually, it comes back to what James was saying in his last argument. One of the things the Tories are trying to do with the economy is to keep on board some of their people who voted Tory in 2017 but Remain in 2016. They are trying to say to you, look, you know, you might think that there are some economic risks involved in Brexit, but the risks of Jeremy Corbyn's economics are bigger. And I think that's one of the things the Tories are trying to land with this attack. They're trying to keep together that economically focused bit of their coalition.
James, our polling guest, James, which party out of the Tories and Labour do you think comes out best in a way from the spending rise we're seeing? Because the Tories have been criticised quite heavily for coming up with these figures. Fake news, and some suggest they shouldn't have done it in the first place. But do you think it's ultimately a net gain for them?
So it's a slightly perplexing row for the reasons that James just said, but coupled with the fact that the Tories' own proposals are A, obviously lavish, and B, uncosted. So the ground is pretty shaky that they're fighting it from. On the other side, Labour do better where they could turn spending commitments into real concrete things that make sense in people's lives. So we will open a Sure Start in every community. Okay, people probably don't know what Sure Start means in that sentence, but at least that's a thing. We will spend more than £1 trillion. We can debate the number, but that doesn't... is a trillion, how much bigger than a billion is a trillion? Most people sat at home don't know and have switched off by the time I've got to the end of the question. So it's weird because the much more substantive debate is around the overall approach to the economy, the role of the state, regulation, private assets, tax rates. There's like a really interesting economic argument that they could be having and maybe they'll get to. But at the moment, it's this weird confected argument that's like someone had something left in their drawer from 2015 or 2010 and has just pulled it out again and decided to run the same argument.
Now, James, we have a deadline on Thursday for all the candidate selections, and we've had some of the last safe seats going as of last night and over the weekend. Are we getting a sign, I suppose, of a flavour of what the next generation of Tory MPs are going to be like? It switches with or changes with every leader. And if you look at some of the candidates who should, in a way, have a seat guaranteed, relatively safe seats, you have lots of people who have worked in Number 10 under Boris Johnson, Boris Johnson supporters. So what are we looking at in terms of the new generation?
So I think that, you know, the Tory MPs in these relatively safe seats, they are all going to be leavers or remainers who are very reconciled to the referendum result. I think if you look at these Tory shortlists, you also, without a doubt, see an attempt to kind of... I think this Tory shift to what one might call the kind of common ground of politics. So perhaps a little bit more open to, you know, big spending on the economy in a kind of Boris Johnson kind of, you know, never met a bridge he doesn't like kind of way, is, I think, going to become a kind of new feature of this. I think one of the interesting things, though, is the big change in the makeup of the Conservative Parliamentary Party, though, isn't going to come from these safe seats, I don't think. It's going to come from how far, to use your phrase, how far over the red wall they get. Because those MPs will turn up to Parliament and their constituencies will have very different interests from classic Tory seats. If you end up with the Tories, you know, there's some interesting polling out from the Centre for Towns suggesting the Tories are now in the lead over Labour in small and medium-sized towns. And that should... If that was the logic is correct, that should lead to lots of Tory marginal gains. If you've got lots of people with run-down high streets in kind of post-industrial places that probably do need some government help with infrastructure and all that to get going again as Tory MPs, that is going to change the nature of Tory economics, because it's not a place where the state just stepping back, you know, keeping taxes low, keeping the burden on business low is going to be enough to get the economy growing. So I think that's where the change will come from. Although, obviously, you know, those people could well have their careers interrupted. And I suspect in terms of, if you're looking at the future cabinet, you probably are looking more at these safe seats that we've been talking about.
And in terms of people from the Prime Minister's team, who has made it into those seats? People like Danny Kruger
down in Devizes, Andrew Griffiths, a former Sky boss who famously lent Boris Johnson his rather large palatial Westminster townhouse for his leadership campaign. James Wilde up in Norfolk. You know, you definitely see this. And I think one of the other things about this, which you realise, is, you know, if Boris Johnson wins the majority and gets back to Number 10, well, he isn't going to get back to Number 10 without a majority because he's got no potential partners, then I think you're also going to have to see a kind of retooling of Number 10, because they have lost a lot of people in this way.
Now, the final thing I wanted to talk about is MRP, which is a type of polling, which, if you look at the polling in 2017, James, lots of people thought, well, lots of people thought it was wrong. Perhaps it was right at the time, but it was clearly an election with a shock result. And there was one specific YouGov poll, yep, which did predict we could be heading to a hung parliament, and that was the MRP model. So whenever I speak to MPs, pollster others, that's what everyone's interested in when these polls are going to be released. Could you just talk us through how it's different, yep, to other polling?
Yep.
And does it take a lot longer to do? They seem to be less frequent.
So traditional polls try and just take a national sample. So they assume that, if you imagine the country was a bowl of soup, and if you put a teaspoon in the bowl of soup, that will probably taste the same as all the rest of the soup. And that's the principle that national polls work on, which is that they just take a random bit and it'll be like the rest of it. What MRP does is assume that there's some structure underneath it and that the geographical distribution of voters differs. And that is really important if you want to turn polls, surveys, into seat projections, particularly when seats have such different characteristics. In the past, it wasn't such a problem because we had uniform swings, so that everything would sort of change in roughly the same way. And so if you knew how it changed, you could then project how the seat level results would change. What we saw in 2017, for example, in a seat like Canterbury, like a true blue seat, suddenly went Labour. What was going on under the surface there was totally different to elsewhere. So MRP is a way of getting under the skin of that. And the way it works is you do a much bigger poll, 10,000 people, not 1,000 people, and you look at how different subgroups within that poll move and change. So the Liberal Democrats might be up 15 points amongst university-educated 18 to 24-year-olds living in highly diverse postcodes. It figures out what are the common factors, and then because you know what the profile of each constituency is, it then says, well, let's see how many 18 to 24-year-old graduates there are in this constituency. We'll give the Liberal Democrats that share there. That's sort of roughly how it works. So it builds a map constituency by looking at these underlying variables and projecting the numbers into each place. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to be accurate, because it's still only as accurate as the 10,000 poll sample that you've got to begin with. So if your 18 to 24-year-old sample is really skewed, like it misses out on the diversity of 18 to 24-year-olds, so it's too white, say, it's going to be wrong. So you still need the raw data to be right, and you need to have the way you do the projections onto the seats to be right. And there's no way of knowing if you got it right until afterwards. So it's really hard. But it does have the potential to give you much more fine-grained geographic analysis of what is going to happen. We've had, I think, two, maybe three versions of MRP polls out so far. They've actually been pretty similar to what the national polls have been saying, as in Tory majorities of around 40 or 50. And that is because the reason the national polls last time were wrong was not because of MRP, it was because they did some funny things to try and correct for errors that didn't actually exist. But basically, it's a way of getting to seat-level predictions.
James, MRP, is that the model the Tories' internal polling is going for?
So the Tories have conventional polling, and then they have their own MRP model. If one wants to really kind of go into... I think that the view is amongst the MRP community, if one can use that phrase.
I think we should do a podcast next time only with MRP members, but for now, speak for the community.
Is that the Tory model... all this is based on kind of Chinese whispers, but the sense is the Tory model is slightly at the more optimistic end of the MRP spectrum. But I think the real influence of all this is how the Tories, in a weird way, are benefiting from 2017. Because everyone is talking, even though the polls are showing quite big Tory leads. I mean, I can't remember a poll which has had a Tory lead of smaller than 7 points, right? No one is talking about big Tory majorities. There's lots of conversation about hung parliament. So, you know, what would Nicola Sturgeon demand for the SNP support? Would the Liberal Democrats put Jeremy Corbyn into number 10? Nigel Farage is talking about hung parliament yesterday. All of this helps the Tories because it all drives home their message that basically, if you want to break the deadlock, the simplest way to do it is to give the Tories a majority. I think there is one thing that I was quite struck by from the Gina Miller MRP model, or RPP, but James, who knows far more about this, can tell us it's essentially the same thing, is but that suggested a Tory majority of 44 on a 7-point lead. Now, what's interesting about that is that the conventional wisdom in Westminster has been that the Tories have to be 8 to 9 points ahead to get, you know, even a single figure majority. If they're getting a majority of 44, you know, on 7 points, that suggests, and if you combine that with the big 10,000 sample YouGov poll by type of town, do you live in a core city or a small town or a village and all that jazz, that suggests the Tories might be doing better in the marginal seats than they are nationally. So the national swing might not be showing that the Tories are picking up the votes precisely where they need them. And I think that's one of the things to kind of keep an eye on in the next week or two.
And now, final question to our guest, James. What do you think... Now, Spectator James just touched on there the fact that there does seem to be a pretty consistent lead in the polls for the Tories. So clearly there are some events you cannot predict in terms of elections. We saw that in a way with the dementia tax and Theresa May. I mean, perhaps if more people had read it, they might be able to predict what could have happened in terms of that manifesto. But ultimately, you have events that you cannot control, and then you have big set pieces which give, I suppose, the parties a chance to change the narrative, to have those big shifts. We have the first debate next week. We are heading up to the manifesto launches. What do you think are the big moments in this campaign, 4 weeks left, which could move things around?
So the Labour Party is not picking enough of the Remain vote up. It's not. That vote is splitting. And if that vote splits, then the Conservatives are going to get a majority. So if I was sitting in Labour HQ, I would be thinking about what are the things we need to do to tell Remain voters that we are your choice, not the other people. There's some stuff that they can't do anymore because their brand is where it is. But the two-headed debate is that opportunity to land that message. And it might mean giving up in some places to win others, but unless they can make progress with that vote, they can't get anywhere. So I think those debates are potentially big, big moments. The other thing is what happens with the NHS as an issue. So if you ask people what is the top issue for you and your family, the NHS is the number one thing. There are a number of polls that have it pretty much tied, like Corbyn and Boris tied. There's some polls with the Tories turning a bit ahead and trust on the NHS. That's a disaster for the Labour Party. So they need to try and create or identify a moment where the NHS emerges. And you might see some very aggressive attack lines around that used at a debate or some other high-profile set piece to be able to try and make that happen.
Thank you, James. And thank you, James. And if you like this podcast, why not leave us a review on the iTunes store or give us some feedback on our new logo?